Welcome to the President's Inbox, a CFR podcast about the foreign policy challenges facing the United States. I'm Jim Lindsay, Director of Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. This week's topic is Shinzo Abe's resignation. With me to discuss the consequences of Shinzo Abe's decision to step down as Japan's Prime Minister is Sheila Smith. Sheila is Senior Fellow for Japan Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. She is an expert on Japanese foreign policy and politics, and she has written widely on both topics. Her most recent book is Japan Rearmed, The Politics of Military Power. Sheila, thanks for being here.
Thank you, Jim. Thank you for having me.
Well, I have to say, Sheila, that the news that Shinzo Abe was resigning as prime minister came out of the blue. I realize he still had one more year left in his time in office, and I think there was a great expectation he would carry it to the end. I know there was a great hope that he would be prime minister at the Tokyo Olympics, which are supposed to happen right about now, but aren't happening until next year. So can you sort of explain to us why he has suddenly decided to step down after serving for the longest term of any Japanese prime minister?
2020 was a hard year for Prime Minister Abe. It's been a hard year for his country, but his sudden resignation was on the basis of health. He has a chronic health problem, ulcerative colitis, that he's had his entire life. It was the flare-up of this that caused him to resign the first time he was prime minister in 2007, but it was back and apparently back with a vengeance. He made several hospital trips, which is when people began to think, uh-oh, perhaps this is more serious than everybody thought. But I think you watched the unfolding of the coronavirus in Japan. As you mentioned, it was a blow to the prime minister specifically because he was so keen on the Tokyo Olympics, the Summer Olympics, as being this sort of, you know, resurgence or showcase for Japanese progress, for economic progress that he has been working on since he came into office in 2012, but also the technological skills of Japan. There was so much that was going to be on display this summer. And I think he really had a lot vested in it. So that was a setback. But he was also widely criticized for his handling of the coronavirus. Now, that may be surprising to our American listeners.
I was going to say, in comparison, Japan has barely experienced the disease.
Right.
Certainly not compared to the United States.
Certainly. But the numbers were going, they were ticking up again. He was criticized largely for being slow off the block, so to speak, for being somewhat hesitant. And of course, that, you know, like every government, Japan's government had to adjust as more cases emerged and as the community transmission increased in Japan. But relative to other countries around the world, Japan was not doing badly, but the Japanese public were somewhat seeing him as somewhat sluggish on the policy direction that he was taking.
When Prime Minister Abe announced his resignation, my understanding is that he apologized to the Japanese people for not being able to fulfill his term. And so I have to ask, is this typical? Is there something we should read into it? Because it's hard for me to imagine an American politician resigning for health reasons and apologizing to people for not carrying out his or her full term.
I had two impressions. One is, yes, apology is something that you do when you cannot meet the expectations of your voters, in this case, as a politician, or if you're a corporate executive, if you have not met the expectations of your employees or your stockholders. It's a common Japanese way of saying, I'm sorry I let you down. So that's not unusual. But I think when I watched it, I watched the whole speech, seeing him as being actually quite emotional. This was not just a customary kind of, I'm sorry, I didn't, you know, do what I had planned. It was really his sense of he had not managed to do what he had really set his heart on, which was, you know, obviously lead the country and lead it well, you know, help the economy rebound, give the Japanese people a sense of optimism about their future. But there are also some things in that speech that he specifically said, I could not get done. And that was constitutional reform, a peace treaty with Russia, and the resolution of the abducted Japanese in North Korea. So those were three issues that he really felt strongly that he was in a position to do something about, and he didn't manage to do it. So there was a lot embedded in that apology. It wasn't just a customary political nod to the fact that he had to step down. It was also, I think, a deeply felt sense that he had not managed to get done what he wanted to get done.
I want to come back to what Abe's resignation means for Japan and its foreign policy, and obviously the question of who's going to come after Shinzo Abe. But could we just take a moment, Sheila, and just sort of talk about his success as prime minister? Again, he is the longest serving prime minister in Japanese history. I think if we could go back to 2012 and tell people he's going to be in office for 8 years, people would have been surprised. I mean, it seemed to me the conventional wisdom back then is he'd be lucky to last a year, because that's all he really lasted the first time around. Now, Abe succeeded despite, I think, a number of scandals, policies he promised that he wasn't able to deliver on. My sense is his own personal popularity declined after a while, but he was, I would presume, a towering figure in Japanese politics. How did he succeed?
The most powerful narrative that you're getting out of his resignation at the moment is the Japanese public's support for him and his 8 years. So despite his own personal sense that he didn't manage to do what he wanted to do, there was a poll in the Nikkei, which is Japan's business newspaper, and it's quite centrist, but nonetheless, it was 74% of the Japanese people felt he'd done a good job. 74% despite the coronavirus, despite the obvious economic blow that came, and despite the challenges that Japan continues to face, people felt that he'd done a good job. He'd come out with the country ahead. I think his success, there's several layers of this. Part of it, of course, is when he came back to office the second time, he was more dedicated to focus on the economy. His first term in office, he really didn't think at all about Japan's economic performance and was unable or ill-equipped, right, to pull advisors around him who could help him carve about an economic pathway forward. And his health was recovered. Obviously, he was stronger when he came back. The second was the LDP itself. And I think that's an important piece of the Abe legacy too. And that is that when he came back, of course, remember in 2012, the LDP had been in opposition, had been the party out of power for 3 years. Now, the party that was in power at the time was fumbling all kinds of issues. So the LDP was welcomed back by the voters in late 2012. But the party had also been chastened when it was out in the woodshed, so to speak. Right. And so it came back with very considerable attention to this question of party unity, right? Inside the party itself, factions were going to get along. We were going to make this happen. We were going to get the confidence of the Japanese voter back. So he and the leadership of his party were very dedicated to making sure the LDP didn't yet again slip up and didn't yet again fall into fractious, you know, contention over policy issues. So unprecedented party unity, which then helped them in the polls. And that was the subsequent elections of 2014 and 2017, the LDP, considerably with very little opposition, managed to continue to have a two-thirds majority in the lower house of parliament with a small coalition party nonetheless, but managed to have that foundation for governance that I think is so important in a parliamentary system.
How much of Abe's success was due to the missteps of his opponents? I recall when the LDP lost, there were great hopes for the Japanese Democratic Party. I actually happened to be in Tokyo during the elections, and everybody was excited. It was a new day dawning. But last I checked, the Japanese Democratic Party had split. What was happening on that side of the equation?
So that's the thing. The DPJ, when it came into power in 2009, rode a wave of expectation as well. And they were the reformists. They were centrist left. Reformist is probably the best way to understand them. They had a lot of younger people, younger politicians. People were technocrats. People were policy wonks. But they were also a fresh face for Japan. As you know, the LDP has been in power either in majority or in coalition since 1955. 2009 was a watershed election, trying something different. And the second party that rose to be able to really contend with the LDP at the polls, the Democratic Party of Japan, really looked like it was going to be able to lead Japan in this future of reform and refresh, if you will, for both social and economic policies. It didn't manage to succeed. It was badly ill-equipped for governance. It was fraught internally as a party, but also with its coalition partners. It faced two considerable challenges: the Great East Japan earthquake of 2011, and then the Chinese challenge over the sovereignty of the Senkaku Islands in 2010, and again, more conspicuously in 2012. So the DPJ left office with their tail between their legs, so to speak, but it created a setting within the LDP that they felt that they had badly dropped the ball. And it was really factional infighting and internal kinds of tugs and pulls that had kept the LDP from power. And so this party unity piece, I think, is a really important one, and one as we look forward to Abe's successor, that's going to be something to watch.
Well, let's look forward then, Sheila. And can you explain to us how the process is going to work to pick a successor and who that successor is likely to be?
Sure. So there's an LDP presidential election that needs to take place. And there's several ways under the LDP, the party rules, that this can go forward. One is what would happen in a normal presidential election for the party, which is you would have half of the votes be from elected Diet members, and then the other half would be from party.
That's the Japanese parliament or their Congress.
That's right, their parliament. So partly would be representatives in the legislature, and half of it would be party members who are rank and file party members. And represent all of Japan, right? All over the country. That would total up to, I think, somewhere around 790 votes, somewhere around there. So that's an even split between rank and file and those who are already elected. And that's a normal electoral process. The second way, and this is probably what's about to happen, is that they declare it's an emergency because a sitting president of the party and thus prime minister, right, can't fulfill his term. And so that's where we are today. And so I'm expecting that Mr. Nikai, of the secretary general of the party, to announce that this is the way they're moving forward. Now, that would basically include party members, so again, national legislators, as well as one representative from each of the prefectural governments. Therefore, it would be a lopsided balance in favor of the legislators in the National Diet. The danger here, of course, this is going to be, I believe, this is going to be presented as the option as a desire for continuity, for stability, especially during the coronavirus, but also it'll help to reassure people that Prime Minister Abe's foreign and security policy are going to continue to be in place, right? It's a difficult moment out there in the region, right? But I think there's a internal tug and pull here between the candidates. So you asked about the candidates. There is the person that many people thought that Abe and Mr. Aso, who is his deputy prime minister, who between them have the largest number of members of factions, right, in the party. Everybody expected Mr. Kishida, who was the former foreign minister, to be the pick, as sort of the princeling that would carry on the Abe legacy. His own faction is relatively small. It's about 47 people, so he couldn't do it alone. He would need the backing of the Abe faction, then Mr. Aso's faction as well. Abe has not said anything yet, but Mr. Aso has indicated that he's not going to support Mr. Kishida at this point. So Mr. Kishida doesn't look like he's going to succeed. The person who does now look like he's going to get the backing is the chief cabinet secretary, Mr. Suga. And he's an unusual choice in Japanese politics because he's a sitting chief cabinet secretary. He doesn't have a faction of his own. He's not a heavyweight within the party. He doesn't come from a political dynasty, right? He's a self-made man and a successful politician. So Suga-san seems he has declared he's going to run, and it looks like the major factions are lining up behind him.
I'm curious, Sheila, when we look at the factions within the LDP, are they organized around ideology? Is it personality? Is it place? Something else?
So that's a good question. I'm not sure I can answer it at this particular moment, but it's usually around person. So the leaders of factions, the factions are called factions based on the name of the faction leader. So the Aso faction, of course, is led by Mr. Aso, former prime minister, finance minister, and current deputy prime minister. The other factions are led by others who have inherited them. There's the Takeshita faction. Mr. Nikai, who's the secretary general of the party, has his faction. Mr. Kishida has his faction. Ishiba Shigeru is somebody I have not mentioned and we should talk a little bit about. Ishiba-san was the defense minister. He was previously secretary general of the party when Mr. Abe had two successful elections. He is somebody who is very popular with the rank and file in the party, but does not carry the majority of support from elected members of the legislature and the Diet. But if you look at opinion polling and consistently over the years, if you ask the Japanese people who they support, Mr. Ishiba comes in the highest, usually somewhere in the 30 percentile. Everybody else that we're going to talk about as candidates are down in the double digits in the teens, or maybe even lower than that. So there's something about Ishiba-san that the Japanese public like. There's something about Ishiba-san that the Japanese rank and file members of the conservative LDP like, but he is not popular among his fellow Diet members. He's seen as a bit of a lone wolf, and he also exited the party at one point and then came back, which some of the party elders have yet to forgive him for. So therein lies a little bit of the tension. The factional balancing act, of course, is all on the headlines and the TV news in Japan at the moment. We're watching that old-fashioned, you know, who's supporting who kind of dynamic. But this is a party, remember, Jim, that really had to work hard at appealing again to the Japanese people, not being the party that controlled itself and designated its leaders, but a party that was open to new faces and would be able to appeal at the ballot box to the Japanese voters. So there's a bit of tension in this process today that I think is important to note.
Okay, so we're having a lot of behind-the-scenes maneuvering here as everyone's sort of trying to assess who has what strength. And I imagine the prospect of elections in the near term are also shaping all of those conversations, because presumably you could be setting up somebody for a long run, and maybe you don't want to set somebody up for a long run. But let's sort of draw back from the sort of trying to read the tea leaves, so to speak, on how this is going to play out in the LDP. And if we could talk a bit, Sheila, about what this means for Japan's foreign policy. And I mean, we have the issues of relations with the United States, relations with Russia, relations with the Koreas, obviously relations with China. So let's sort of do them sequentially. Sure. Let's begin first off with relations with the United States. Prime Minister Abe earned the reputation as something of a Trump tamer. They developed a rapport. I remember when Donald Trump was elected back in 2016, Prime Minister Abe went well out of his way so he could show up in New York, famous gift of golf clubs to President Trump. They played golf on a number of occasions, and many people attributed this to Abe's ability to sort of keep Japan from being the focus of criticism from President Trump. But Abe's leaving. Right now we're talking about in the offing potentially contentious negotiations over host support for U.S. military bases in Japan. So what comes next?
I would say a lot of Abe's time as prime minister was spent trying to manage our unpredictable president. And as you know, the Trump administration was very focused on leveling the playing field, so to speak, with our allies on both trade and host nation support or defense spending. And so the Japanese politicians were not unaware of the challenges that they were facing here. So the Trump-Abe relationship, people make a lot of it as a personal relationship. He got considerable criticism from some quarters in Japan for kowtowing to Trump, for overly pandering to Trump's idiosyncrasies. But I think there's two pieces of Abe's management of Trump that are important, what he got done and managed to deflect with the president. And that includes North Korea, remember? The very beginning of the Trump presidency, of course, was a pretty volatile, unpredictable year with North Korea. Missile launches and lots of rhetoric, fire and fury, right? There's all of that going on. And Abe was very close to Trump at that point, spoke to him a lot, had a lot to talk about, a lot to help him understand about the region. So there's that piece. But the other is, obviously the trade agreement. Abe tried very hard to persuade Trump that the TPP was in American interests as well as in regional interests, obviously Japan's interests. And then the last piece I think that's important is the China piece. Here is a government, as you know, I've written a little bit about the Japanese response to China's rise and the increasing military pressure Japan is feeling from China. I think Abe played a very important role in trying to demonstrate to Trump, again, quietly, why the allies in the region, not just Japan, but Australia, India, why the Indo-Pacific framing of the challenge of China was in the best interest of the United States. So very persuasive and very effective, I think, there as well. But he also navigated around Trump, around Washington. And I think that's the less appreciated part of Abe's success on the foreign policy side. So CPTPP, the U.S. said no, Abe went ahead.
I think you're going to have to explain what the I can't remember the initials, too many PPPs.
The
Comprehensive Progressive Trans-Pacific Partnership, the successor to TPP.
Thank you. CPTPP is the successor trade agreement to the Trans-Pacific Partnership. It got a new name when the United States exited. And so many people thought he would back out too, because without the United States, what would be the value? But he didn't. He and Australia and others decided to go forward, and he was very dedicated in getting that done. He also got a trade agreement with the EU. I mean, that's something that Japan and the EU had struggled with for a long time and, really got stuck on automobiles and agriculture, right? Sounds familiar. But he got that done. The other things he got done is he managed to engage a lot more stakeholders in the sanctions, execution of sanctions against North Korea to implement the UN Security Council resolution. The British and the French began to do maritime sanctions surveillance with Japan in the region. He brought Europe back into thinking that Asia was also in its interests. So there's a lot of things that he navigated sort of around the core U.S.-Japan partnership that I think was also pretty impressive.
Do you think any of the successors or likely successors to Abe will be able to continue those policies? Maybe I should say want to continue those policies?
I think the hard nut to crack is if President Trump is reelected, whether or not that level of closeness at the highest level of the U.S. and Japanese governments can be maintained. I think that's a real question. And part of it is just personality dynamics. Part of it, of course, is there's some difficult issues ahead. I think the one area where his successor will want to continue to put emphasis will be on the Indo-Pacific. That is sort of Japan's whole of government regional approach, right, to counterbalancing some of the less auspicious implications of China's rise. And in with that, Japan has strong partners in Canberra, in Australia, and also in New Delhi, in India. So that, I think, is a constant. Whether the next person will be as effective a spokesperson for that Indo-Pacific vision remains to be seen. But the policy, I think, will not change. Challenges, we haven't talked about where Abe failed or was not successful, was obviously Russia. He tried hard in his first 4 years of office to engage Putin in a discussion about a peace treaty. He often...
Can I just stop you right there? Because I think to many people listening to our conversation are going to say, peace treaty? Where's the war? What are we talking about here? So maybe you want to give a little bit of background as to why you would have a prime minister in 2020 trying to work out a peace treaty with the president of Russia.
Yeah. So the peace treaty that never got signed is the peace treaty at the end of World War II. Japan signed a multilateral peace treaty called the San Francisco Peace Treaty with the United States and many other countries. It signed bilateral peace or normalization treaties with South Korea and China, but its northern neighbor refused to sign a peace treaty because Japan wanted to negotiate over the return of what Japan refers to as the northern territories, four small islands north of Hokkaido, the Russians refer to as the Kurils, and they see those four little islands at the bottom of the larger Kuril island chain to be part of a larger grouping. So they said, no, thank you. Those are ours. If you go up to northern Hokkaido, by the way, some of them are visible from Hokkaido. Two of them are very close. But that was the sticking point. Again, a territorial dispute with Russia was the final sticking point in the peace treaty negotiations, and it never happened. There was, of course, diplomatic relations, and they managed to have a diplomatic agreement, and they had economic ties, and of course, visited each other and did everything that you would think a normal relationship would contain. But the peace treaty remains to be concluded. And that's one of the pieces that Abe wanted to resolve and didn't happen. Largely, I believe, because Putin was not really interested at the end in making a compromise on the islands and didn't see the peace treaty itself, I think, as being in Russian interests or important to him.
Do you imagine that Abe's successor will make Russia and a peace treaty a priority in the way that Abe did, or simply put this in the pile of things it would be nice to do, but prospects are pretty dim?
I think this will go back on the pile of things that are, gee, wouldn't it be nice, but really kind of hard. And I think there's nobody in the lineup that I can see who would effectively try to get Russia back to the table. I think some of the candidates are just likely to, if not ignore it, they're just likely to go about business as usual with Russia. If you saw Mr. Ishiba, you might see somebody who is actually quite more, I wouldn't say strident, but much more willing to sort of challenge Russia on some of the issues, especially the military issues and Russian behavior in and around northern Japan, and now also down through the East China Sea, has been quite conspicuously aligned with Chinese military behavior. And the Russians have been putting considerable pressure on Japanese air defenses up north. So I think you might find in Mr. Ishiba, for example, and perhaps even another candidate, if there's an incident, some pushback against Russia on the military side of things.
Okay, so that's looking north. Let's look west from Japan. We'll sort of talk first off about Korea. There are obviously the two Koreas. I think that you mentioned that Prime Minister Abe in his resignation speech mentioned his failure to get back Japanese who had been kidnapped by the North Koreans. But I think it's also safe to say that relations between Tokyo and Seoul have been cool, perhaps frigid in recent years. Do you see a change in leadership in Japan changing that at all?
So I think the Japan-South Korean relationship has deteriorated significantly in the last several years. And there's a number of factors, some of them longstanding, some of them new. It would take us way too long to do a thorough, you know, coverage of the reasons and causes and the tit-for-tat back and forth that we saw between those two countries last year. Suffice it to say, some of the war legacy issues remain unresolved in the eyes of many in Korea. There have been court cases in South Korea that have now reached the Supreme Court. and have led to judgments in several cases of punitive damages assigned to Japanese companies. That for the Japanese government, they see that as a violation of the basic agreement that normalized relations in 1965, where there was a discussion of compensation for war damages. So there's two sides of it looking at the problem very differently, and it has become involved in the Korean court system. And the President Moon says, I can't, you know, that's judicial branch of government. It's not something that the executive branch can negotiate. So we have a bit of a stalemate on the resolution of some of these specific claims by citizens, by the way, not the state, but by citizens, against their treatment during the war by Japanese companies. The larger picture, of course, is the security environment. We have the United States and Japan and South Korea, of course, have a huge stake in making sure that our alliances are coordinated should there be tensions. We saw that in 2017 with the successive missile launches by the North. The two alliances are not integrated, so they're not integrated operationally in the way, for example, NATO would be in the case of a conflict. They run parallel to each other, and they organize.
There is no Japan-South Korea mutual defense treaty or alliance.
There isn't, no. So Japan has a treaty with the United States, and we have forces on the ground, 50,000 or so. South Korea has a bilateral security treaty with us. We have about 28,000, 29,000 troops on the peninsula. So our Indo-Pacific command works through both alliances, and there is synchronization, and there was extensive synchronization of the alliances during the 2017 missile launches. But the South Koreans, for obvious reasons, do not want to have Japanese military on their territory. They're very sensitive to that, given the history between the two countries. But what did happen in 2016 is that the two countries managed to sign an intelligence sharing agreement. It has a horrible acronym. It's called JISOMNIA. Basically, it allows Tokyo and Seoul directly to share data. If there's an incident, Seoul would share data with Japan, and Japan would also similarly share data. That became the focus of part of the tit-for-tat political back and forth last year. Seoul said, we're going to pull out of this. That was a response to Japan saying that it was going to take Seoul off a preferential trading list because it believed that Korean companies were perhaps lax in their exercise of sanctions against North Korea. So the convolution here is that the security agreement's getting tangled up with trade, which is also embedded in this larger question of resolution of war legacy issues. And it's a very, very difficult tangle to untangle.
Okay, so we should anticipate continued turbulence on that front.
Yes.
Okay. Let's talk about the other big country to the west, the bigger country to the west, which is China. Mm-hmm. Do you anticipate a new Japanese prime minister taking a different approach to Beijing?
No.
Okay, we can move on.
We can move on. That's it. President Xi was due to visit Tokyo for a state visit, his first state visit to Japan, a culmination of several rounds of very high-level summitry dedicated to trying to get the bilateral Japan-China relationship back on track. So Xi was due in Tokyo in April, but of course, because of the coronavirus, that was postponed. I don't see a successor changing the desire for Japan to move forward with that state visit when and if the circumstances permit. But again, this is a relationship that has underneath it a pretty strong strategic tension, which is the rise of Chinese military power and the exercise of that power in the vicinity of Japan in the East China Sea. Increasing Chinese attention to the Taiwan Straits, of course, is for somebody who can't imagine a map of Northeast Asia, and many of us can't, but Taiwan is not very far from Japan's southwestern islands. And so all activity in and around Taiwan is of great concern to the Japanese defense ministry.
Sheila, I want to close by going back to one of the issues that Prime Minister Abe listed as his regret for not getting accomplished during his prime ministership, and that was constitutional reform. And maybe you could sort of briefly just tell us a little bit about Article 9 and what the prospects are for reform. And if you want to plug anything you've done on this score, go for it.
Thank you. On CFR.org, for listeners who are interested in this issue, we have an interactive info guide that will help you understand the 1947 Constitution, which is still in place today. It's not been revised since General MacArthur arrived in Tokyo in 1945. It is an issue that not only Mr. Abe, but many conservatives in Japan feel strongly about. I think it's also true if you look at Japanese public opinion polling. The Japanese public is more open to discussing constitutional revision. Doesn't mean that they want to discuss everything. And one of the articles of that constitution, of course, is the now very well-known Article 9, which says Japan will not use force to settle international disputes. In other words, the Japanese military militaries primarily organized on the principle of self-defense. That, I think, most Japanese think Article 9 has prevented Japan from having a conflict in the post-war period. I think they see it as their statement of intent that Japan will not initiate war. And that premise is widely supported by the Japanese people of all stripes. There are some who feel that perhaps the time has come for Japan to be a little bit more offensive in the way it organizes its military, but most Japanese see Article 9 as positive for Japan. Abe himself put forward a proposal for reform for Article 9 that had mixed results even within his own party. Some people didn't think he went far enough, but what he wanted to say in the Constitution is this. He wanted to add a sentence or two that said the self-defense forces were constitutional. To put an end to the internal debate that's aged in Japan for almost 70 years about whether or not the self-defense forces themselves are a problem under the current constitution. So he wanted to put a period, punctuation mark, on that debate at home and wanted the self-defense forces to feel that they were supported by the Japanese people. I don't see, with one exception, I don't think the current candidates are interested in constitutional reform. Ishiba Shigeru is the gentleman who is sort of seen as the anti-Abe candidate. I think he would seek to reform the security arrangements with the United States before he would undertake constitutional reform as a political cause. I think he's a hawk in that sense of he's very focused on defense issues. He wants Japan's military to be stronger. He wants Japan's capability to be enhanced. And he may want some more equities to be discussed in the U.S.-Japan partnership. But I don't see him as a political objective coming into office advocating reform. The party itself is split on it, even though it's part of their platform. I don't think many people feel that the Japanese people are behind them on this issue. So I don't expect it to be a priority for the next prime minister.
Now, we should note that the Japanese have what they refer to as a self-defense force, but lest anyone think that means they have very little in the way of military power, they would be wrong. Japan's self-defense force is actually quite effective, particularly in terms of its naval capability, correct?
That's correct. And there's a book on that called Japan Rearmed.
Which is
that'll tell
by?
You just how lethal. Written by yours truly. The idea that Japan doesn't invest in military power is wrong. It's always been in the top 10 if you look at any indices of spending and investment in military power, but it's also one of the most capable militaries in Asia. So don't think twice about challenging the self-defense forces if you're in the neighborhood, because they've had a lot of training during the Cold War and with our forces, and of course they see their mission very seriously.
On that note, I'll close up the President's Inbox for this week. My guest has been Sheila Smith, Senior Fellow for Japan Studies at CFR and author of Japan Rearmed, The Politics of Military Power. Sheila, thank you very much for joining me.
Thank you, Jim. It's been a pleasure.
Please subscribe to the President's Inbox on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, wherever you listen, and leave us a review. They help us get noticed and improve the show. As always, opinions expressed in the President's Inbox are solely those of the host or our guests, not of CFR, which takes no institutional positions on matters of policy. Today's episode was produced by Zoe Collis with Senior Producer Jeremy Sherlock. Zoe did double duty as a recording engineer. As always, thanks, Zoe. Special thanks go to Margaret Gatch for her assistance. This is Jim Lindsay. Thanks for listening.